This is called a revisionist conference, and we call ourselves revisionists. Now, for many of those who are here, of course, there's no need to explain exactly what that means. But for many Americans, the term revisionist has a negative connotation. In our society, it's come to mean, widely, someone who distorts history for an agenda of their own. But revisionism is not that, of course, or else we wouldn't be here today. It's not often that our President George W. Bush says things so correctly that I agree with him, and I'm happy to hear him say, but sometimes he gets things right. Last June, he was responding to those skeptics of the claim by his administration and the U.S. government that Saddam Hussein had to be attacked by the United States because he had a dangerous arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. So large and so dangerous was this arsenal, President Bush and other American leaders said, that the United States could not wait even weeks before bombing, attacking, and invading that country. Well, even in the aftermath of the war, of course, the question arose around the world, where are the weapons of mass destruction? And George Bush, in June, responded to those people who were questioning the existence of these weapons of mass destruction by calling them revisionist historians. He says, "I know there's a lot of revisionist history now going on," he said at one point. He says, "There are some who would like to rewrite history. Revisionist historians is what I like to call them," he said. Well, he's right, of course, in a sense. Revisionism just means simply to look again, to take another look at things, based on new evidence or new insights. But revisionism began as a real movement in the 1920s, primarily as a movement of skepticism against Allied propaganda of the First World War, that is, the propaganda of the winners of the First World War. Because, as Harry Elmer Barnes says, the tendency of governments to lie is most pronounced during times of war and conflict. And as you know, our president says right now that we're in a kind of war, not against an enemy, but a concept, against terrorism. It makes me think a little bit that in 1939, Britain and France would have been well advised not to declare war on Germany, but to declare war on Blitzkrieg. It's about that silly. But in any case, revisionism is especially important in countering official history, doctrinaire history, dogmatic history. Now, a number of times today, various aspects of revisionism were talked about. And it's quite true that although we deal a great deal with the Holocaust story, there are other issues of history that we also deal with, and rightly so. Now, we don't deal with the Holocaust because I don't think any of us have some special fascination with the chemical properties of Zyklon B. We deal with the Holocaust story because of the enormous political, social, and cultural role it plays in our society. It has an iconic status. And as a number of speakers have mentioned and emphasized here today, and as I emphasized as well, the iconic, official kind of status, special status, that the Holocaust story has in our society has been pointed out and underscored many, many times, including the very fact that we are required to hold this meeting under the circumstances we did today. But revisionism deals with other issues as well. And as President Bush indirectly but so rightly pointed out, right now revisionism is dealing, as it were, with Middle East history. When I was a boy, I, like most Americans, was very strongly pro-Israel in my sentiments because that's really the only side of the story that I heard. My view of the Middle East conflict, the Arab-Israel conflict, was approximately that of the motion picture by Otto Preminger, Exodus, which now I think is pretty widely recognized as a cartoon of history, a caricature of reality. But it reflects, of course, power in our society. Now, thanks to the internet, thanks to a lot of other things, there's much greater awareness, not only in the United States, but certainly around the world, about the true history, the true background of the Middle East conflict. One speaker already mentioned something that we've put in the journal at one time, that America had no enemies in the Middle East until the founding of the State of Israel. Indeed, none of the great powers were so beloved in the Arab or Muslim world as the United States was in 1948, because unlike Britain, or unlike France, or Italy, or Spain, or some of the other countries, the United States had never had colonies in any of the Arab or Muslim countries. There was an enormous reservoir of goodwill in the Arab lands and in the Muslim countries toward the United States. Of course, the situation is very different today. And I trace it, in large part, to what I call the original sin of America's Middle East policy. And that came in 1948. The United States recognized, well, the State of Israel was proclaimed in May of 1948. Interestingly enough, and this is kind of just parenthetical to what Mr. Carlson pointed out, up until hours before the State of Israel was proclaimed a state, the Jewish leaders, the Zionist leaders, did not agree about what this new state was to be called. Some wanted to call it Judea, some wanted to call it Israel, they had other names, and so forth. And the first postage stamps issued by this new state did not even say Israel on them. It said Hebrew Post in Hebrew letters. And the United States government issued a proclamation recognizing the new state of Israel. It was a typed out statement by the White House, and the name of Israel had to be written in pen, because up until right just before the proclamation of the State of Israel in 1948, as I said, the leaders did not even agree about what the new state would be called, except it would be a Zionist state and it would be a Jewish state. Now, at that time, there was a very crucial debate that took place in the White House and in Washington about America's policy toward this new state. Now, this is known to specialists of the subject, but this point should be much better known among the American people, and something I didn't know until fairly recently. Secretary of State at that time, under President Truman, was George C. Marshall, who had been Chief of Staff of the military during the Second World War. George C. Marshall, as Secretary of State, was adamantly opposed to the United States even recognizing this new state of Israel, even recognizing, not apart from the question of giving aid or support to this new state, even recognizing it. And in this, he was supported by Dean Rusk, who at that time was a high-ranking official in the State Department. He was supported in this by George Kennan, who was in charge of the policy department of the United States State Department. James Forrestal, the first U.S. Secretary of Defense in the Truman administration, he opposed recognizing the State of Israel. And it came down to a fateful meeting in the White House, in the Oval Office, with President Truman there, Secretary of State Marshall and other high-ranking officials were there, and Clark Clifford, who was a political advisor to President Truman, who died not too long ago, was a young man at the time, he presented an argument in favor of recognizing the State of Israel. It's interesting, in fact, that his argument went into the Old Testament and Hebrew scriptures and so forth. As when the meeting was opened, General Marshall, George Marshall, said to Mr. Truman, "Why is that man here?" In other words, this is a meeting about deciding United States foreign policy. Why is a man who is an advisor on domestic politics for the Democratic Party even in this meeting? Well, Truman was a little taken aback, and he said, "He's here, Mr. Secretary, because I asked him to be here." And Clark Clifford went through this long polemic in favor of recognizing the State of Israel. Well, as he spoke, Secretary of State Marshall became more and more angry. He became furious, actually. And when he kept his temper until Clark Clifford had stopped his presentation, and then he said, "To recognize the State of Israel will demean the office of the President of the United States, And he told Truman that if you recognize the state of Israel, I will not be able to support you in the next election. Now, from George Marshall, who was a very stern, impressive man, those were powerful words. Now, it was the policy of the United States government not to grant recognition to countries unless they had several basic criteria. One of them was that they had to have clearly defined borders. You don't recognize a state that has amorphous or undefined borders. It had to be in firm control of its territory. That was another standard criteria the United States used to have for recognizing a country. Well, certainly in that day, the state of Israel, at that time, was just proclaimed. It was at war. It had no real borders. But more than that, the man who was the Middle East bureau chief in the State Department wrote a lengthy memorandum at the time. And he warned that if the United States sided with Israel in this conflict that was already taking place between the Zionists and the Arabs, the United States would inevitably find itself embroiled in conflict interminably for years to come with no end in sight. Well, his prophecy became true. But more than that, President Truman, at the end of that meeting, gave Mr. Marshall a kind of vague answer to the inquiry about Marshall or what Marshall had said. And Truman thought about it, and he later said in his memoirs, and he said in interviews, that on no issue in his entire political career had he come under such pressure, such blackmail, as he did over the question of recognizing the state of Israel. And finally, as he pointed out, he said, I've got millions of Jewish voters to be accountable for. There aren't any Arabs in this country to be accountable for, and so he recognized the state of Israel. Now, what he did in doing that was to put the narrow political interests of his party and himself, as General Marshall said, ahead of the interests of the United States of America, much less the interests of humanity. And that decision by Harry Truman in 1948 to put political interests, narrow interests, above the interests of the United States was what I call the original sin of American Middle East foreign policy, because that is the same path that has been followed by every American president to a greater or lesser degree ever since. And the prediction made by the Middle East section chief of the U.S. State Department has come true in a very, very sad and tragic way. Not only has the U.S. special relationship, as politicians like to call it, with Israel cost the American taxpayer many, many billions of dollars, it has also cost American lives. Now, one of the most dramatic examples of that came in 1967 with the killing of 34 or 43 Americans on board the USS Liberty. But it's coming even more true today. More than 600 Americans have died in the war in Iraq, in a conflict that was based on propaganda reasons that have proven untrue. In fact, it's kind of a bait and switch. But the reasons we were given for the war, that Saddam Hussein had dangerous links to international terrorism, that he had an enormous arsenal of dangerous weapons of mass destruction, those are the reasons that were primarily given at the time, a little more than a year ago, for the U.S. invasion. Since then, since it has come to the fore that there were no such links, in fact, arguably, well, not just merely arguably, but obviously, the danger of international terrorism and of terrorist threats to the United States and the rest of the world has been exacerbated, has been made worse by the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And it's now painfully obvious to the world that the pretext given for the war about weapons of mass destruction is not true. So that now the argument has shifted. Well, the United States should have invaded because Saddam Hussein was a bad man. Well, that's especially a piquant, ironic argument coming from somebody like Donald Rumsfeld, who, when Saddam Hussein was at his worst, was twice in Baghdad shaking hands with this man at a time when the United States supported the regime of Saddam Hussein. Now, what I want to stress is that historical revisionism, which is above all skepticism of official dogma and official claims about the about history does not merely apply to the Second World War, it applies to the conflict now that we are engaged in the world. And that's why it's of greater importance and pertinence today than ever. Not quite in the same way that some people may think, but in a very, very strong and powerful way now around the world. Now, what's behind what I call the original sin of the United States' special relationship with Israel? Well, Harry Truman himself admitted it. And it's been admitted on one way or another by many people in the years since then, including Jewish leaders and non-Jewish leaders. The United States sides with Israel as an expression of the power of the Jewish Zionist lobby, of Jewish Zionist power here in the United States. Now, a great deal has been written about this whole question of Jewish Zionist power. There's a leaflet by me on that subject that you can get for free at our table. I recommend very highly the book Culture of Critique by Professor Kevin MacDonald, which we also sell, which is advertised, in fact, in the latest flyer that Nintide has distributed. For those who are familiar with this, please bear with me. But just a few quotes. Jews in America make up approximately, it's an arguable thing, 2 or 3% of the population of the United States. And yet, Stephen Steinlight, former director of the National Affairs of the American Jewish Committee, he noted in an essay what he calls the disproportionate power of Jews, which he said is pound for pound the greatest of any ethnic cultural group in America. Now consider what that means, the greatest of any ethnic cultural group in America, greater than Mormons, who make up a somewhat larger population group, larger than blacks, who make up something 12, 13% of the population, but more significantly, larger than Catholics, who make up something like 40% of the American population, more, in fact, than white Americans, who make up the great majority of the American population. Because on this issue, and this is the important thing, the power is not merely in an obvious way, it's also through control and influence and a grip on our cultural life, our academic life, our media, and so forth, has effectively neutralized the ability of the vast majority of the Americans to think straight on this and all other issues relating to history. As I mentioned earlier, in our society, a Jewish-centered view of history is obligatory. Now, that may seem like an exaggeration, but it's exemplified in so many ways. Indeed, much of the debate that takes place in the United States about U.S. Middle East policy is purely in terms of which course is really better in the interests of Jews and Israel. We're permitted a debate within a very careful, controlled schema. We're allowed a debate between the labor supporters of Israel and the Likud supporters of Israel. John Kerry, as I mentioned earlier, in fact, in several recent weeks, has been stressing that he'll be even more pro-Israel than George Bush. I thought to myself, well, can one make a blank check just simply bigger and it gets more effective? George Bush has made America, in this regard, a laughingstock. He's the only political leader of any country, including Israel, who would describe Ariel Sharon as a man of peace. It's ludicrous, really. This is the leader of a country whose own country, Israel, has confirmed that Ariel Sharon was co-responsible for a terrible atrocity in 1982 during the Lebanon War. We're supposed to have trust in a man who in 1982, during the Israel invasion of the country, lied not only to the world, but also even to the people of Israel and even to the cabinet of the Israeli government in launching that war in 1982 in Lebanon. Now, I could give details about that, but these are facts that are easily confirmable to anyone who cares to look into it. To continue again about this whole issue of Jewish power, Seymour Lipset and Earl Robb, writing in a book entitled Jews in the New American Scene, said this, quote, "During the last three decades, Jews in the United States have made up 50% of the top 200 intellectuals, 20% of professors at the leading universities, 40% of partners in the leading law firms in New York and Washington, 59% of the directors, writers, and producers of the 50 top grossing motion pictures from 1965 to 1982, 58% of directors, writers, and producers in two or more primetime television series. The influence of American Jewry in Washington, said the Israeli Daily Jerusalem Post, is, quote, far disproportionate to the size of the community, Jewish leaders and U.S. officials acknowledge. But so is the amount of money they contribute to election campaigns. One member of the influential conference of presidents of major American Jewish organizations estimated Jews alone had contributed 50% of the funds for Bill Clinton's 1996 election, re-election campaign. It's also reliably estimated, this was in the Washington Post, Jews contribute 50% on average of funds to the Democratic Party and something like 20%, 40% of funds to the Republican Party. No other single group in American life has that kind of clout. And it's fortified because of the tremendous sense of self-awareness and focus that Jews have in American life. This was brought home to me vividly in January when I attended a rally of some 900, 800 Jews at a synagogue in Newport Beach, California. Now, this is a very wealthy community. It's one of the wealthiest communities in California, perhaps in the country. It was announced publicly, so there was no reason why I or anybody else couldn't be kept out of it. And it was announced in the newspaper that the congressman for that area, Christopher Cox, would be speaking at this meeting. And so Ken and I, on the evening of the meeting, we went over to take a look. There was a great deal of security and so forth. But what came out, I think, vividly to any person who's not Jewish, there were some non-Jews in the audience there besides ourselves and Christopher Cox, who came to see, or in the case of Christopher Cox, give an accounting to those he has to give an accounting to. What comes out so strongly from a meeting like this, and it's one thing to read about it in books or magazines, but to see it to be there is to experience the tremendous self-absorption, the tremendous dedication, and the tremendous focus that Jews have about their interests. Now, this was a meeting that took place in a synagogue. I don't think there was any mention of God in this entire meeting. There's many people, this was referred to earlier, many people have this idea, well, Judaism is sort of like Christianity or Islam or Buddhism. That's a tremendous fallacy. People who don't know anything about Judaism assume that because it's a religion. But it's a religion unlike any other religion, because it's a religion without a universal ethic. It's a religion the purpose of which is almost the deification of the Jewish people. The Jewish people are the end and purpose of the religion. And this is unlike any other religion. In fact, Jews are very vague when it comes to the question of what's the purpose of being a Jew. For a Christian, it's salvation, or for a Muslim, or it's nirvana, or for other religions. For a Jew, the purpose of the Jewish religion is the maintenance, the furtherance, the increasing of power of the Jewish people. It's unlike other religions in that regard. And this came out very vividly and very strongly at this meeting, whereas in a church or a mosque, most people might be praying to God for help about the health of their children, or for peace, or any other issues like that. At this meeting, the focus was entirely on power, how to get it, how to hold it, how to keep it. That was the whole focus. And the main emphasis of this meeting was to make sure that the Jewish grip on Washington stayed tight. Because as the speakers at this meeting said, and this is something I want to get into, Israel and Jews now have no real friends, reliable friends, anywhere in the world except in the United States. And it's more essential than ever that the Zionist Jewish grip on Washington stay in place, because if that's lost, if that grip slips, then it's finished. Bush made a very interesting statement also about a year ago, another one of his cocky statements that might come back to haunt him. He said, "Those people who aren't with us are against us. Well, something remarkable is happening in the world. That is, just about the entire world rejects this war, rejects the United States occupation of Iraq, and rejects U.S. policy and Israel policy in the Middle East. This is a remarkable thing. Never in my lifetime have I seen America so distrusted, so reviled, so loathed, so isolated as it is today. It's a shameful thing, really, and millions of Americans should ponder very seriously what that means, why it is that the United States is now the only real country that supports Israel diplomatically, with military equipment, with military aid, with economic aid, and so forth. This has been brought up in a number of dramatic votes in the United Nations. In fact, you may read about it, happens quite often now. The United States repeatedly is the one country that vetoes resolutions in the Security Council that are critical of Israel in one way or the other. But more dramatically, in the General Assembly of the United Nations, recently there have been several lopsided votes. One of them was about whether to condemn this enormous wall that's being built on occupied Palestinian land, completely contrary to international law. Maybe that doesn't matter to some people. It's unjust, I mean, whatever you want to call it. It's a wall, if you've seen pictures of it, it's twice the height of the Berlin Wall, for heaven's sakes. It's built on occupied territory. Well, a vote in the United Nations on that wall was approved by the General Assembly. I think the vote was 144-4. The four countries voting against it were Israel, the United States, Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands. Well, the Micronesia and the Marshall Islands are two tiny dependencies that together have a population smaller than my hometown of Costa Mesa, California. Essentially, Israel and the United States are alone against the entire rest of the world. And I mean the entire, including countries that are considered very strong allies, traditional allies of the United States, such as Australia or Canada or Germany or South Korea or whatever it happens to be. This is an extraordinary state of affairs. But when Bush says you're either with us or against us, what increasingly that means is we have an entire world that rejects this whole course, this war, these policies. Now, a lot can be said, and it's a remarkable thing, that with each passing week, more and more evidence comes to light to show that this war was planned, carried out, executed, not really for American interests, but for Zionist interests, or by people who are ardent, either Zionists themselves or ardent supporters of the Israeli state. The one country that benefited from this war in a dramatic way is the state of Israel, because it's in the state of Israel's interest, as an article just in the last week in the Forward, the prominent Jewish paper said. Israel succeeded in humiliating, demolishing, destroying yet another Middle Eastern country that was or is potentially an adversary or enemy of Israel. Indeed, the logic of the American policy, as a number of Jewish Zionist writers have emphasized, is not to stop with Iraq, but to go on and bring similar wars to Syria, to Saudi Arabia, to Iran, until the entire Middle East is, as they say, well, the propaganda word is democratized. What it really means is brought under a kind of Zionist American hegemony. Well, luckily, the entire world virtually rejects this, and for obvious and very good reasons. And this offers to us, I think, not only an enormous opportunity, but reasons to be very optimistic, to look to the future with confidence if we know how to act properly and intelligently. More and more voices have been raised around the world about the power of this Jewish lobby here in the United States, this Zionist power, this Jewish Zionist power here in the United States. As I've quoted, Bishop Desmond Tutu in South Africa has been very explicit about this. In Britain, the longest-serving member of the House of Commons, his name is Tam Dalyell, he said the United States Jews have a grip on American foreign policy. He was condemned, of course, but he refused to back down when he said that. In contrast, in our country, a congressman in Northern Virginia, Moran, when he merely said to a small group of people that this war would not have taken place if it had not had the backing of Jews, he was forced to grovel, repudiate, to crawl, even though the statement is in fact the truth and accurate. Again, as we've seen in so many examples, when it comes to this issue, truth is no defense. It's irrelevant. What's at issue here isn't even feelings. It's power. It's power. Power that manifests itself not only in wars that are immensely destructive in both treasure and human life, but it's manifest also in the distortion of our culture and the distortion of our history. Because any people that has a distorted sense of its own history is unable to know what to do, because the best guide to the future is an understanding and a study of the past, of history. And when history is distorted, then any kind of rational, wise policies for the future become impossible. This was also manifest in a remarkable speech made on October 16, 2003, in Malaysia by the Prime Minister of that country, Mahathir Mohamad. Now, he was speaking at a conference at which the audience included presidents, prime ministers, emirs, monarchs, other high-ranking officials from 57 countries. In this speech, Mahathir Mohamad, most interestingly, he said Jews have become so powerful that he says they rule this world by proxy. This is a deliberate and direct reference to the power they have, especially in the United States, to have wars waged in their interest on our behalf. And he said they get others to fight and die for them. Above all, right now, Americans. He said, and this is another interesting aspect I think that is pertinent for us here today. He said, Jews wield this tremendous power, he said, even though, in his words, the Europeans killed 6 million of them during the 1940s. Okay, regardless of how wrong he is about that particular thing, two things stand out from this that are interesting to me. First, when I was young, and in the immediate aftermath of World War II, we were told that the terrible crime of genocide against the Jews was the work of the evil Nazis, or of Hitler and his henchmen. But over time, the blame increasingly is laid at the feet not merely of the Nazis or of Hitler, or even of the Germans. Increasingly, it's laid at the feet of everyone in Europe. Indeed, for some Jews, it's a collective sin of all of humanity. And this has been manifest in the last several years when shakedowns and blackmail of whole countries, Switzerland, a neutral country, for heaven's sake, in the Second World War, was in the headlines. Not merely the Germans, but Hungarians, French, Swiss, Italians, Poles, all of Europe are held collectively responsible for what is considered this greatest of all crimes. Even the Vatican is held responsible, co-responsible for this thing. Now, that's one aspect of it that's interesting to me, because it's an absolutely logical thing from the Jewish point of view, because the Jewish religion postulates that the persecution that Jews have experienced throughout history is not a reflection of anything, not a manifestation or caused by anything that Jews do that's bad or odious or irritating, but it's in fact a further affirmation of the chosenness nobility of the Jews. So that what is postulated is this contrast between Jews on the one hand and all the rest of humanity on the other. So that the responsibility, therefore, logically, for the Holocaust is not put on just a small group of people, but increasingly on all of humanity. Now, that's one aspect that's interesting to me. The other aspect that's interesting is that Mahathir Mohamad condemned and laid out reasons for condemning this Jewish Zionist power, even though he accepted, in his view, that, as he put it, the Europeans killed 6 million Jews during World War II. His point was that in spite of the catastrophe that Jews suffered during World War II, their power is as great as it is. Now, this raises an interesting point. There was a time in which, I heard often the argument that if one can only pop the balloon of the Holocaust story, if one can only show the Holocaust story is not true, then this whole edifice of Jewish Zionist power will come tumbling down. Well, I'm now more convinced than ever that that's not true, that the Holocaust story itself is an expression of this very power. It has the grip it does in our society because of this power. And as long as that power stays in place, the Holocaust story will continue to play the role it does in our society. This is manifest in a sort of obvious way, for example, by the fact that the term Holocaust didn't begin appearing in encyclopedias until the late 70s or early 1980s. The term Holocaust didn't even appear. It was not used at all during the Nuremberg trials or in the 1940s. Occasionally it was used by some obscure Jewish writers, but it didn't come into popular usage until the 1970s, especially the late 1970s. This use of this term and this propaganda, this enormous propaganda campaign, which is also manifest in the U.S. government agency, the United States Holocaust Memorial Council, which runs this enormous United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., this campaign is an expression not of some new insights or anything, but of it's a manifestation of tremendous power. I remember at the time that the Holocaust Museum opened, there was an article in the Washington Post, an essay in the Washington Post by a well-known Jewish writer. I forget his name, but it was reprinted actually in Hans Schmidt's newsletter at the time. And he said, "What is being celebrated today is not history, but Jewish power." He put it in some words like that. And that's in fact the truth. It's an expression of power. And when Bradley Smith goes to campuses and he talks to people, students parrot back exactly the understanding that they're supposed to have in our society. So that as long as this power stays intact, not only will the distortion of history regarding Second World War be intact, but also the Middle East and many other aspects of history as well. Now, at the last IHR conference, this was 2002, we had speakers addressing a number of different topics. Tony Martin was one of the speakers. He's a black professor at Wellesley. He spoke about his experiences at Wellesley and about how this campaign and lobby works on campuses. It began because of his focus on the Jewish role in the transatlantic slave trade. Another speaker at our conference, Tom Sunick, talked about the suppressed story of the mass killings of ethnic Germans in Yugoslavia during and after the Second World War. We had another speaker, a Palestinian, speak about the suffering of his people under Zionist occupation and as victims of Zionist dispossession. We had another man, an American, who was a veteran of the attack in 1967 of the USS Liberty, and he spoke about the suppression of information about that. But what all these people had in common were two things. First, that the points they are making about history are not generally known, they're suppressed or taboo or whatever. And second, that they're all suppressed or distorted or tabooized because of this same Jewish Zionist power. So that it manifests itself in our society, in our cultural life, and especially in how we learn history, across the board, in every way that affects our lives and affects our understanding of the past. There's a joke once. Somebody says, "What's worse, ignorance or indifference?" And the quick smart aleck answer to that is, "I don't know and I don't care." Well, we've had some talks here today about indifference especially and ignorance, because those are really the two things that we are trying to combat, ignorance and indifference. We don't merely want people to understand more than they do, to be more aware than they already are. We also want that knowledge to be put into battle, to be used, because what is happening is a worldwide conflict now, a global conflict that involves all of humanity. And what is striking is that whether you are a conservative or a liberal, Whether your primary loyalties are to your religion, to your ethnic group, to your country, to your heritage in whatever form, you will come up inevitably against this great Jewish Zionist power, which seeks to suppress, obliterate all of these loyalties, because whatever they are, even if it's a merely an honest support for the principles of justice, of freedom of expression, whatever it is, inevitably one will come up against the power of this powerful Jewish Zionist lobby. And that's why, when Mahathir Mohamad gave this address last October to officials, presidents, prime ministers from 57 countries, including Vladimir Putin of Russia, including Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan, the president of the Philippines, he was given a standing ovation. A standing ovation. A speech that has never been given before. That is, a speech openly talking about this power, not merely to a body within one country, but to a conference with heads of state and leaders representing dozens of countries. Not even in the Second World War did something like this happen in any of the Axis countries. So that increasingly what we are involved in is a global struggle in which, fortunately, we find ourselves not only on the side of what is right and true and just, but we are also on the side of the vast majority of humanity in this struggle. And what is important is to come out of this conference today, and those people who hear the voice of myself and other speakers hear this today, come out of this not merely more aware or with greater understanding, but more determined to act, to do something, to be active in a struggle that is not merely for, you might say, abstractions like justice or truth, but is truly a struggle for the interests of us all and the interests of humanity. Thank you.